Good evening and welcome to this evening's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and the Tech Museum. My name is Angie Coiro. It is my pleasure to introduce Michael Malone, author of The Intel Trinity, How Robert Noyce, Gordon Moore, and Andy Grove Built the World's Most Important Company. A native of Silicon Valley, Michael graduated from Santa Clara University. He began his journalism career at the San Jose Mercury News as the nation's first daily high-tech reporter. While at the Mercury, he was nominated twice for the Pulitzer Prize for his investigative reporting, and he later served as editor-in-chief at Forbes ASAP. Currently, he's a columnist for ABC News, an op-ed contributor of the Wall Street Journal, a contributing editor to Wired, and an adjunct faculty member at Santa Clara University. He's the author of 20 books covering the worlds of business and technology. He's also produced 4 episodes of the Emmy-nominated PBS series, The New Heroes. In 2004, Michael was named a Distinguished Friend of Oxford University, and in 2010, was one of the first recipients of Santa Clara University's Leaders Legacy Award. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Michael Malone.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a great honor to be here. Way back when it was just a dream of the Sunnyvale Historical Society and the Palo Alto JCs, I actually was the first person to write down a vision of what the tech would be. And every time I walk in here, I'm absolutely thrilled at what a vital Valley institution it's become. As for the Commonwealth Club, I've been involved in a number of events and broadcasts over the years, but tonight will be the first time that I'm alone on the opposite side of the questions. So I'm a bit intimidated by that. It's great to see some Valley legends here. I see Glenn McLaughlin, Bob Grimm, some of the people that built this Valley. I expect them to raise their hands when I get things wrong as we go along. What I propose to do tonight is talk about failure. And not just talk about it, but celebrate it. After all, Silicon Valley is the one place in America, indeed the one place in the world, where failure is at the very heart of what we do. Indeed, it defines us, and it has made us the historic success that we are today. I want to explore that, especially in regards to the Valley's most important company, Intel Corporation. But in doing so, I want to deliver a warning as well. The notion of failure being inextricably bound up with the Valley's success was, I think, first elucidated by Regis McKenna, Silicon Valley's most famous marketing guru. What Regis said was that while everyone celebrates the Valley's successes, the real truth is that we are actually all about failure. Now, he'd been saying that for years when I first quoted him in print, I think, in the San Jose Mercury News, though it may have been Forbes ASAP. But the meme didn't really take off until Tom Peters, wrongly attributing it to me, put it in one of his best-selling books on management. That phrase has now entered the culture, I believe because of 3 things. It was new and contrary to the accepted view. It was shocking. And because it had more than a grain of truth. Like all of us, anyone who has ever lived and worked in Silicon Valley, especially if we've been part of one and most likely more startups, we know that the fatality rate of new businesses in Silicon Valley is about 95%. This is always true, but it's usually hidden by the fact that most of those companies never get beyond those initial Starbucks meetings. It's really only during the bubbles, e-commerce, video games, disk memory, PCs, DRAMs, and scores of others over the last half century that the true level of bloodletting becomes visible. Over the years, we've come to learn that this boom-bust cycle is not an anomaly of Silicon Valley, but intrinsic to the entrepreneurial process. 1,000 companies have to try and fail for that one Intel or Apple or Google or Facebook to emerge triumphant and go on to change the world. At the same time, though much less obviously and much more slowly, a similar bloodletting takes place among the Valley's big and established companies. If you look at the 25 biggest companies in the Valley from 1960, every decade until today, you'll find that few companies have managed to stay on the list more than once or twice. Where's Varian today? Watkins Johnson, Sun Microsystems, Novell, Four-Phase, Tandem. When faced with this much failure, you have two choices: succumb to it or learn to understand it. Silicon Valley isn't known for surrender, so we've learned to use the notion of endemic failure to our advantage. Thus, whereas in most of the world, a resume featuring a dozen employers in an equal number of years would be a mark of shame, we see it as a sign of ambition, risk-taking, and talent. Elsewhere, when the company you created dies, it's an albatross around your neck, symbolic of your incompetence. Here, it's perceived as a great opportunity to try again. And can we invest in your new company? Indeed, here in Silicon Valley, failure, at least the right kind of failure, can be a career boost. We've learned to judge each other through a matrix that distinguishes both success and failure as being either good or bad. On that chart, a good failure, that is one in which you showed vision, leadership, and high competence, but were defeated by an unexpected market shift, a new technology, or an unstoppable competitor, is typically valued higher than a bad success, one in which the company got lucky despite its faults, or you were in the right place at the right time. Like Moore's Law, this matrix exists at the heart of Silicon Valley and is one of the things that makes us different and special. It certainly powers the complicated dance between entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, and it's key to the world of executive recruitment. It has the value of not only being true to real life, but fairer. It punishes the phonies and the overrated and rewards the talented and the overlooked. We all love the idea of a good failure because it offers each of us the chance at redemption. But what I want to suggest to you tonight is that our acceptance of failure and our celebration of the good failure is also overrated. The real truth is failure, and as much as we like to dress it up, failure never becomes success. It may lead to success, but that's a different matter. When it occurs, failure is what it is. Moreover, what constitutes a good failure? That you worked hard? Well, working hard but incompetently is not success. That you got blindsided by a new technology or a competitor? Wasn't it your job to see those things coming? The prototype failed? Weren't you supposed to hire the right engineering talent? You ran out of money? Well, Jim Morgan said 35 years ago that cash is the mother's milk of entrepreneurship. Didn't you read that? How come you have such nice desks? In fact, if you look closely enough, there really is no good thing. There's no such thing as a good failure, with one exception. If you learn from your failure deeply enough that you can successfully apply what you learned to your next challenge. Take away all the myths and romance, and I think that is what venture capitalists and others really mean by a good failure. That is, you screwed up, but otherwise did a solid job in running your startup, and we think you've learned enough from your screw-up how to handle it better next time. And we believe that strongly enough that we're willing to bet money on you again. But don't screw up this time, or you will be marked forever as a real failure, and you will never see another dime of investor money. It is this belief in the ability of people to learn, to change, that I think is at the heart of Silicon Valley's embrace of failure as an asset. And that brings me to Intel Corporation and my new book. Now, much has been made about the title, Trinity, with its religious connotations, and even more, the subtitle, The World's Most Important Company. But what many reviewers have missed, and what the real message of this book is something that shocked the employees of Intel when I first mentioned it at a speech I gave at the company headquarters a couple months ago. It is that Intel has made more mistakes. That is, it has failed more than any company I've ever studied. We're talking about a $50 billion company. But as I looked at its history, all I saw was one failure after another. How does a company get from there to there? Well, I mean failure in a positive way. Companies that don't make mistakes come in two forms, right? There are startups who make one big mistake and die. And there are other companies, typically big, mature companies, that become so risk-averse that they don't make any mistakes at all, and they fade away to oblivion. Only companies that take risks ever really make big mistakes. And Intel has taken more risks, big and small, over the last half century than perhaps any company ever. Now, part of that comes from the nature of Moore's Law, of which Intel is the great protector. The pace of change demanded of this law, that of doubling the power of chips every couple years, is so fast, so unrelenting, and so unforgiving that Intel is essentially required to take four or more existential risks every decade as it challenges physics itself to create the next microprocessor generation. But it also comes from Intel's culture. This is a company that prides itself on its toughness, its fearlessness, and its industry leadership. It has never been content to maximize profits and fade into a comfortable retirement. It is built to fight, to compete. And no company, no matter how tough or smart, wins every battle over the course of a half a century. So, why has an Intel, through all these many failures, ever succumbed? Why did it ever join the ranks of Intersil, AMI, Signetix, AMD, Fairchild, National Semiconductor, Zilog, and the hundreds of other chip companies that either disappeared or became niche players and also rans? Why didn't it become one of the tens of thousands of Silicon Valley companies that have disappeared from history? I believe it's because Intel is that rarest of companies, one that has learned how to learn. It has learned how to turn a failure into a good failure. And rare yet, especially under the tenure of Andy Grove, arguably the greatest CEO of the last half of the second 20th century, it's learned how to turn that good failure into an actual success. Let me give you some examples. The microprocessor. The microprocessor arguably is the greatest invention of the last 50 years. When you read the story of the microprocessor, it sounds like the great march of history. We go from the transistor to the integrated circuit and different kinds of integrated circuits. We put them all on one chip. It all happens with a team of four guys, Hoff, Mazur, Fajin, and Shima at Intel. Intel adopts a microprocessor, rules the world. Well, that story is completely wrong. The reality was Intel was a memory company. It had no interest in getting in the microprocessor business. It took on the gig because it needed the money and had a Japanese calculator company write a large check. They built the thing, the Japanese calculator company died, and Intel was left with it. So did Intel adopt it and embrace it and turn it into its key product line? No, Intel didn't want it. It didn't know what to do with it. It took Ed Gelbach and Regis McKenna to write a 30-page list of possible applications for the microprocessor to convince Intel's management to adopt it. None of the things on that list ever actually happened. Even that was a bluff. In the end, Intel moved into microprocessors because the memory business disintegrated under the Japanese competition. The last two guys to sign off on Intel becoming a microprocessor company were the two guys in charge. Andy Grove and Gordon Moore stuck with memories till the bitter end, till every one of the 30,000 employees at Intel knew they had to get out of memory and get into microprocessors, except for the chairman and the CEO. This is obviously a problem. Now, learning from its mistakes, as the story goes, and it's apparently not even apocryphal. It sounds like a fable, but Andy and Gordon literally sat in a room and said, "What are we going to do?" And they said, "Well, we don't know." And one of them said, "Well, if it was two other guys sitting here, what would they do?" And I think it was Gordon that replied, "They'd go for microprocessors to get out of the memory business." And I think it was Andy that said, "Then let's go outside and come back in as those two guys." And that's what they did. Maybe another one, Operation Crush. Second generation of microprocessors with the 4004 and 8008, and then the 8080, Intel dominated the microprocessor business. With the next generation, the 8086, the company got complacent. They got a little full of themselves and thought that no one was going to catch them. And so they rolled out the device, and all of a sudden, Motorola came to market with a better microprocessor. Motorola caught them. Not only caught them, passed them. Now, keep in mind, in those days, if you missed a generation of microprocessors, which a lot of companies like National did, you died. There was no coming back. So what was Intel to do? Well, it came down to an extraordinary moment called Operation Crush. And this is one of Andy Grove's greatest moments. Over the course of a weekend, he gathered up the best marketing and product people he had and basically locked them in a room at Intel for the course of a four-day weekend and said, don't come out until you have a solution. Well, in this group was Bill Davidow, Regis again, a lot of these people that you've all heard of as living legends now. One of the reasons they are is because of Operation Crush. Basically, they came out with literally a solution. They said, Motorola has a device, but what we have is a device, maybe not as good as theirs, but we have design tools, we have support equipment, we have emulators, we have all these kinds of things. And so good were these peripheral things. In fact, Bill Davidow has always argued that the emulator box for the Intel 8086, if he had put a screen on it and a keyboard, he would have beaten Apple to the personal computer by 4 years. Intel came out and said, we're not selling chips anymore, we're selling answers. We're selling solutions. We're going to help you design it, we're going to help you make sure it works. That was Operation Crush. Motorola was so astonished by this, it was like a UFO had landed in the semiconductor industry. There was no previous experience of this paradigm. Then Motorola froze. It literally went into a 6 months paralysis, came out with their standard catalog, didn't respond in any way for 6 months. During those 6 months, one of the things about Operation Crush was all the Intel salespeople were required to almost double their quota of design wins. So these poor bastards were running everywhere. They were going to hobby shops. They were going to any place that might buy one Intel microprocessor. And one guy did the impossible, what nobody else had the courage to do. He walked into IBM. He walked into IBM Boca Raton, which just happened to be where IBM had its secret skunk works to build the IBM PC. And that moment, Intel got the design win. It's a creepy story. I mean, Intel engineers had to sit on one side of a black curtain and reach through and feel the IBM PC because they weren't allowed to look at it. IBM didn't even buy the chip. It bought a cheaper version of the chip. It didn't buy the 8086, it bought the 8088, which was actually a lower power version. But it went into the IBM PC. And just like Microsoft with Windows, that is the turning point in consumer electronics, because from that point on, it's the Wintel PC, right? It's the Intel microprocessor, it's the Microsoft operating system. Intel wins the microprocessor war at that moment, all because of Operation Crush. Now roll forward. Operation Crush is so successful that Intel now is, amazingly, for a company that's in the chemical business making these tiny chips, it's now the smartest marketer in all of technology. This is before Apple really hit the ground hard. Intel invents a program, comes up with a program called Intel Inside. Everybody here knows it because it was the most successful marketing campaign in the history of high technology. It put Intel on the list of best known brands with Coca-Cola and Chevrolet for a number of years. It was an astonishing success. Intel basically told you that when you went to the retail store and you saw this box, you weren't supposed to look first at what the box did. You were supposed to look and see if the microprocessor in the center of it was made by Intel. And that convinced you to buy it. And that's what we all did. Brilliant campaign. One problem. It created for Intel an expectation among its customers that Intel didn't know it had put there. Basically, by reaching the consumer, it had made a compact with those consumers that said, you buy Intel Inside, Intel will take care of you. You don't have to worry about the computer. You know that it's the state of the art. It's the best you can get. It will never let you down. And it didn't. Right up until the moment a professor in North Carolina did a division, and somewhere out there at the 14th place, he got the wrong number. Okay, now this had been going on in logic and in mini computers and mainframe computers and processors for a couple decades. There were always bugs, and they always just sent out a notice to the big manufacturers because they were talking to other engineers like themselves. Well, Intel had created Intel Inside. It wasn't talking just to those designers. It was talking to consumers. It was talking to 8-year-olds. It was talking to people in the developing world. And it convinced them that Intel was flawless. Intel didn't make mistakes. Well, that division error, which was figured out, the average person would run into it once every 10,000 years, created chaos. If you all remember the scandal, it was on the evening news. People were afraid that airliners were going to fall out of the sky, that gas stations pumps were going to explode, that the power grid would shut down. Intel's reaction was their next failure. And Intel's initial reaction was, you people are stupid if you're worried about this. Okay, this is not a great marketing campaign. And leading the charge was Andy Grove. Now here's the thing, Andy was right. To worry about this was absurd. And yet, Intel had violated this compact. And the crisis got bigger and bigger, and it was snowballing all through a couple of weeks ahead of the Intel finally going into desperation mode. Andy went home for the weekend, and he came back on Monday morning and said, I've changed my mind. We're going to replace every Pentium in the world if people want us to. It was one of the great 180 pieces of management in modern business history, and it worked. Within days, nobody wanted a new Pentium. They just wanted Intel to tell them it was all going to be okay. And Intel finally did. That's a wonderful example of turning a failure into a good failure into a success. Now, let's look at Intel now. Intel made another big mistake 5 years ago. This was actually a good failure in the sense that Intel basically did everything right. The president at the time, CEO at the time, Craig Barrett, had studied everything. He had all the data. He had all the facts and figures. And he took Intel and sent it in the wrong direction. He sent Intel after networking, figuring that PCs would be around for another decade in force and that networks were going to be the big thing. What he didn't pursue was mobile. And as we all know, mobile won. Mobile dominates the world right now. Intel had to do a U-turn and start chasing this market that was already closing up. It's been chasing it for the last 5 years. If you want to see how hard it was on Intel, take a look at a picture of Paul Otellini the day he took the job as CEO and the day he retired 4 years later. Hard job. Intel's been clawing its way back now for all these years. If you saw the numbers 2 weeks ago, the financials, it's back. Intel managed to claw its way back. This is an example of character. Not many companies miss that badly and pull themselves all the way back. This is something almost unique to this company. Now, in the title of my book, I called Intel the world's most important company. And I did so because its microprocessors are at the heart of the world's economy. And because the company's commitment to maintaining Moore's Law drives the world's innovation. But it could have just as easily meant that Intel stands as a testament to the power of failure in Silicon Valley. Intel is a company that suffers endless failures because it takes endless risks. But more than any company, it has shown that it can recover from those failures, that it can claw its way back to success. Intel is a company that never gives up. It continues to take the risks, it continues to risk the failures, even existential failures, and always come back. It's one of the reasons why Andy Grove was such a great CEO. It's such a testament to the fact that When all of its competitors are essentially faded into history, Intel is as vital as ever. And ultimately, it's the reason why Intel is the world's most important company. Thank you. Now, I think I'm going to get interviewed. There you are.
Want to come sit with me? Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Thank all you guys for being here, too. I know how hard it is to get down here commute time. You know, the thing about this damn town is when the economy's lousy, the traffic's great. You know, and we're complaining that the economy's bad, but we're ignoring the fact that we're actually getting there on time. And then when things are booming, we bitch about how bad the traffic is because we can't get anywhere.
I want you to know I was grateful for the 45 minutes it took me to get through northern San Jose. I was grateful every minute.
Did anybody actually come here based on the piece in the Chronicle today? Nobody drove down from San Francisco, right? They're still in transit. Really, I figured those guys are still in Belmont, you know. Well, thank you very much. I'm very appreciative of that.
I read something of yours outside the book, and I just wanted to follow this thought because you were writing for the Harvard Business Review. And I want to quote your article. When Philip Ziegler was writing a biography of Lord Mountbatten, he grew so angry at his subject's behavior, he kept a note on his desk that read, "Remember, in spite of everything, he was a great man." And you went on to comment, "A lot of historians and biographers have felt the same way about their subjects."
Yeah, there was a few times, frankly, the most charismatic of the three, Bob Noyce, was the one who frustrated me the most writing about him.
Why?
His affairs. Yeah, it just, that was tough. You know, I came off of writing two other business histories. One of them was Hewlett-Packard. It's called Bill and Dave. And those two guys never got in a fight for 65 years. It was almost too good of a piece to write. I actually wanted more friction.
Well, you got that.
The one that had me almost join the Marines was writing about Apple Computer, and especially Steve Jobs, version 1.0. He was a truly, because I grew up with him, and I knew him from almost the first day of Apple. He was a very difficult human being. And to write about him for 6 to 9 months, every night I started working on it later and later. I got to the point I would start at 3 o'clock in the morning because I almost had to sneak up on that book to keep working. That was tough.
Well, you know, the cliche in Silicon Valley is that, you know, the people who succeed the most may well be the ones who have the most social rough edges.
I guess. That's certainly true now. I think this Web 2.0 social networking generation, these are pretty antisocial kind of people, a lot of them. They're basically code writer nerds who grew up and made $10 billion and without ever really learning the social graces in between. And I think that's creating a lot of the problems we're seeing in San Francisco, this sort of resentment of the oligarchs and stoning of buses and that sort of thing. My favorite generation in the Valley is the first generation. You know, these guys, Noyce Grovin Moore, Charlie Spork, Jerry Sanders, these guys were all the sons of working blue-collar guys. They all were semiconductors is a chemical industry. I mean, these guys got their hands dirty. They were real-life people. They had, like, families and houses, and they had normal lives. And so they weren't necessarily antisocial, dysfunctional human beings.
Although they may have been attracting that line of work known as electronics at the time, may well have attracted a certain sort, because Shockley, the traitorous eight, left Shockley.
Yeah.
And he was later diagnosed in absentia, you know, speculation that he was autistic, and that was part of his problem, trying to relate to people.
Yeah, he was like the worst boss in the history of the world, too. I mean, he was truly a difficult human. Anybody here know Shockley? Met him? Any
veterans? I saw the hand almost go up there.
No. I mean, Shockley, he's a very interesting case because he was such a great scientist. I mean, he played a critical role in fixing Bardeen and Bertin's problems with the invention of the transistor. He kind of walked in, gave them the solutions, and walked out and got the Nobel Prize for it. He was one of the great applied scientists of all time. But nobody liked him. And at Bell Labs, they sort of drove him out because they just didn't want him there anymore, as great as he was. He came out to California, and he's capable with his reputation of inviting the best and the brightest new PhDs in the country. And he gets them. I mean, look who he got. He got Noyce, he got Moore, he got Jean Hernie. You know, he got Eugene Kleiner, who basically invents modern venture capital. I mean, he gets the best. They work for him for 6 months, and they're ready to kill him. And it came to the point that they were having secret meetings and developing business plans and running out trying to find investors. And the last holdout was Noyce, Shockley's favorite. And on the morning that they decided to quit, Noyce came down the driveway and got in the car and went with him. And that was the end of Shockley in Silicon Valley. So there were pretty dysfunctional guys. But for the most part, the leaders of the Valley were pretty cool guys. I really admired.
Well, they looked really cool. I mean, they had hipster down before we had the word.
Yeah, well, they were the madmen generation. You know, I got asked today by Fortune about, you know, all these sexual harassment suits in San Francisco and recently and with these dot-comers and all that. And they said, was it like that in the old days? And I said, yeah, they just didn't call it that. I mean, it was madmen. It was chasing secretaries of the wagon wheel. I mean, it was a different kind of, you know, gestalt in 1965.
But they really looked the part. There's a picture in the book, and it's pretty widely publicized elsewhere, and all of them are in the old webbed lawn chairs, you know, and there's Noyce at the side looking over. He's got the thick black-rimmed glasses, and I thought, some things haven't really changed.
Yeah, yeah, that's the great Magnum photo. And there's one indoors and one outdoors, and they all have crew cuts or Ivy League haircuts. They all got skinny ties, narrow lapels. They all look like they're 45 years old and grown up. And there's one guy in there who's 30 years old, the old man. That's Noyce. I mean, that's how young they were, but how old they looked. It's a very cool shot.
While I was reading it, there was this loop going through my head. Was wow, if they were dealing with what people in Silicon Valley deal with now, if their every move was being covered by ValleyWag, if they all had to have Twitter accounts. I mean, these people had the benefit of being able to labor, yeah, under the eyes of the industry, but not under the eyes of the public.
Yeah. Well, they pretty much operate in a vacuum. I mean, you consider that the rest of the world didn't even hear about Silicon Valley until Electronic News came out with a piece in 1970 when Don Heffler was sent out here to write that series, and he named it Silicon Valley. Things were moving pretty fast 12 years before that, and yet nobody noticed. And that was a good thing. I think the Valley was much more successful operating in the dark, you know, under the radar, than it is now. And now, it's like Hollywood. I mean, everyone wants to know about the political positions of 24-year-old CEOs and you know, like literally ValleyWag's covering it. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like for ValleyWag to show up at National Semiconductor in 1968 or 75. I think Charlie Spork would have had them bodily thrown into the parking lot after maybe punching them in the face once or twice. I mean, these guys didn't mess around. These were grown-ups, and they were tough.
It's funny, I'm hearing your tone of voice talking about that. And I did watch the YouTube, there's a very good YouTube, by the way, of your talk at the History Museum, at the Computer Museum. And you talked briefly about Mark Zuckerberg, and your eyes kind of rolled, and your voice went down. And then you, you know, segued past that and talked about something else. And he oversaw a company that, you know, has significantly impacted society, has made multi-millions. Whatever you might think of him and or his generation personally, why is Intel and not Facebook or not Amazon or whatever the most important company?
I'll address that in two sections. Number one, why is Intel the most important? It's not because of the company per se. It's because Intel is the guardians of Moore's Law. Intel builds the microprocessors. And the microprocessor is the core, it's the engine of the modern world. Moore's Law is the metronome of modern life. It sets the pace. The reason life seems to be accelerating is because we're heading up the curve of Moore's Law. If Intel were to disappear tomorrow morning, the electronics revolution would probably end pretty quickly. everything that we've based our world on, the global economy, which is constant change and innovation, would probably grind to a halt. We don't notice it anymore because we're so many generations beyond it. We're way up the food chain. We forget that when we're sitting there working on our Facebook page, that information is going to servers, and at the heart of those servers are Intel microprocessors. They run everything. That's why it's the most important company in the world. Now, my attitude towards the new generation of oligarchs, the young Turks in San Francisco, part of it, I think, is just the nature of the beast. There's 20-year cycles in Silicon Valley that people don't really notice. It's a hardware-software cycle. It's a code-build-stuff cycle. We're about 15 years now into the latest code cycle. It really began with the e-commerce bubble, the dot-com bubble, and continues until now. But as I look out there, I'm seeing hardware reasserting itself. I'm seeing this capital of Silicon Valley is in San Francisco right now. It's been there since about 2000. I see it moving south. I can physically see it moving south just by driving around Cupertino and looking at the new Apple Donut and looking at Tesla up there by Deer Creek Labs in Palo Alto. I can see it in LinkedIn moving to downtown. The woman in Palo Alto that's doing Theranos, the blood lab on a chip, mm-hmm. Sitting right on Page Mill Road next to HP. We're moving away from code back, I think, to a physical industry. And that's a very different crowd. I think the dumbest thing anybody said in the last 15 years was, and the dumbest management decision was when Eric Schmidt allowed Sergey and Larry to put in the Google prospectus, do no evil. That's such a classic software point of view of the world. You know, it's sort of metaphysical. It's not grounded in reality. The genius of these guys is they actually have enormous vision. You know, Facebook is the most pervasive company maybe in history, 1 billion users. So they know how to do that. They know how to scale better than anybody. But when it comes to interpersonal relations, a lot of these guys, they just don't do it. You know, I mean, Evan Biz at Twitter, or Work Twitter, now Medium, normal sorts of guys. But when I look at Facebook and how it never stops trying to monetize people's private information, and that it seems to have no concept of privacy. In fact, it's teaching. I got two kids, 118, 123. They look at me and go, there is no privacy anymore, Dad. Get used to it.
That's a generational thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I also noticed my oldest went around with electrician's tape and covered all the cameras on all of our laptops. So, you know, he may not be as convinced as he makes out. That attitude that people are code, I think is what's causing all the scandals and all the resentment right now. I think when we get back to people building boxes, people with families and kids and lawns to mow and mortgages and all that, I think that's going to change back.
Is it possible that younger generations, I feel like old farts standing up here, you and I, talking about the younger generation, but is it possible that there isn't that understanding of how critical privacy is because they are not of a generation that has seen events in the world where private information was compromised, private information belongs to the government, what the impact and what the potential results of that can be. They haven't lived that.
Yeah, I think it's because when you're 23 years old, you don't have a whole lot of life trail, and you don't have a lot of things in your life that you prefer not to share with near strangers who happen to be friended to you. I think as they grow older, that's going to change. I'm already seeing, interestingly, the millennials seem to have accepted all of this. The post-millennials, the kids under 20, they're different. And I've noticed that there's been a shift in idols. The millennials worship Steve Jobs. The post-millennials, you know, they do a hat tip to Steve Jobs. They're more interested in Elon Musk. And, I mean, Elon's a difficult guy, too, but he's a lot saner. And he's a lot less mercurial. And he builds stuff. And he says he's going to build it, and it looks impossible, and he does it. He does the unimaginable. And I think these kids, the ones that are in robotics competitions in high school and all that, for them, social networks and software are just kind of the backdrop. They've been around it all their lives. It's not revolutionary to them. Mm-hmm. To them, robots and subdermal health monitors and those autonomous cars, that's what interests them.
How come you don't have a Twitter account?
How come I don't have a Twitter account? Oh, God. You know, I think it was Louis C.K. pointed out that every time you do one of those things, you basically become the service representative for your own life. You know? I don't have time. The other thing is, I'm a writer. And as Samuel Johnson said, you know, only a blockhead writes for anything but money. So, you know, why would I write thousands of, you know, tweets, you know, a week and give that stuff away, you know? Facebook, I've never had any interest in Facebook. And my timing's pretty good because my kids are basically quitting Facebook, too. I think Zuckerberg is a genius in one respect. I don't think he understands human beings, but I think he understands technology as well as anybody ever. And what he's figured out is that these social networks are, even though they look immense and stable, they're actually quite ephemeral and fragile. And I think he learned that from looking at, well, he killed MySpace, right? And that was going to be forever. It was too big to die, and it disintegrated. It did a couple wrong things and drove everybody away. I think he understands that Facebook is just as fragile, that if people tomorrow decided not to update their pages, it would go very quickly. So what he's doing is he's created a strategy where he identifies, and one of the things that characterizes the Valley right now is there's so much money. You know,
again, yes.
Hundreds of billions of dollars. I wrote a thing on it a few weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, that Apple's cash on hand, they could buy the entire next generation of startups. Just own it all if they wanted to. They could just take over the venture capital industry. Facebook, I think what Zuckerberg has figured out is there's going to be some big new thing every couple years. It's going to scale up enormously. And so he goes from Facebook, a billion users, jumps to Instagram, right? Pays a lot of money for Instagram, but looking back, he got a steal. Hundreds of millions of users. It's much more profitable than Facebook. But he knows Instagram can't last forever because it's even more ephemeral when you look at it than Facebook.
Right.
So what does he do? He goes out and pays $19 billion for WhatsApp, a company that's 3 years old but has 600 million users. And he's going to build that one up. And he's just going to, I describe it as skipping from stone to stone across the raging zeitgeist. I mean, that's what he's doing. The world's going to keep changing really, really fast. People's commitment and loyalty to any given social experience is short-lived. They're going to jump to the next thing. He's going to be there waiting for each one.
But even with a modern tale like that, you have the same thing in common with the guy who has a tiny grocery store, is that you need a return on your investment. Is he going to get $19 billion out of WhatsApp?
Oh, I think he'll get it in time. Absolutely. Do you know everybody who worked for that company made the minimum, I think, of $55 million? That's if you were vested. So you put in a good hard year of work, and you get $50 plus million. I met a guy, his daughter had worked there, I think, 4 months, and she was going to get like $9 million, $10 million. She was like 22 years old. What's your follow-up act to that, you know? No, I think Zuckerberg's going to keep doing this as long as he can. I think it's an absolutely brilliant strategy. I think it's a winner. But he is perpetually at risk. The problem is he's got a billion users, but he can't turn that billion into a whole lot of money. And he keeps trying. And the only way he can do it is to get you to give up valuable information about yourself. So in a sense, if you join Facebook, you're at a perpetual war with that company's desire to turn your private life into money.
And last time I was there, I was a 38-year-old man, and I know there are a lot of people doing that.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that Facebook faces, this is what I think Zuckerberg most fears, is everybody's grandma's on Facebook now. You're 17 years old. You're not signing up for something your grandma uses, right?
So uncool.
Yeah. And so you got to keep the cool factor high, which is what she's doing brilliantly.
I want to get to some of our audience questions because they're piling up here. As a biographer and writer, would you have any interest in writing about any of these new companies we've been discussing? Get closer to Zuckerberg or get closer to Musk? Because you were very close to the people you were writing about here.
Yeah. Because I created this thing called Silicon Valley Comes to Oxford 15 years ago, I've brought all of the new hot CEOs to England every November. So I've met them all. I know them pretty well. Elon's an interesting case. He's a very driven guy, very private. I was on a plane with him once, sitting next to him. He was going through satellite trajectory tables for relaxation. So the original guys at Twitter, Evan Biz, they're very different. One's a very outgoing advertising guy. The other one, Ev, the genius, is the son of a Nebraska pig farmer who got out of Nebraska. Very quiet, very shy. Reid Hoffman, I think Reid will probably write his autobiography. He's of LinkedIn, and he's now a famous VC. He's an incredibly bright guy. He's writing books now. Eventually, he'll do one. But I may do one. I'd like to do one on Reid. I think he's very interesting. I think Mark Andreessen, who I've known since his Netscape days, he's so bright. He's one of these guys that talks fast because his brain is actually multi-processing. You know, you get the feeling he's designing something new and reading a business plan all while he's talking to you. Some of the other guys just weird me out. I'm not sure. There's some companies, eBay's had a story, a book written about them, but not about the guys.
Right.
You know, and Jeff and Pierre are really interesting characters.
You're one of the founding shareholders of eBay.
Yeah. I was actually sitting there with the case of Jolt Cola with Pierre Omidyar and Jeff Skoll, and a couple. I think it was four employees in the company, and we were all so broke that we would pool $10 each and go over to Fung Lum's and buy a bowl of wonton soup. And last I looked, Pierre was worth what, $12 billion, and Jeff is worth about $8 billion. Yeah,
very encouraging. Who coined the term Silicon Valley?
Don Heffler. Anybody here meet Don Heffler? There you go. Okay. Don Heffler was this very, very good journalist who wrote for Electronic News Magazine. It was a tabloid. And he was a brilliant guy at breaking stories. This was in the early 1970s. He spun off and created his own newsletter called Microelectronics News, where he really broke a lot of inside stuff. To the point that if you were seen with a copy of it at National, you were fired on the spot. Most companies, in fact, I walked into National once, and I purposefully had it on, I was reporting for the Mercury News, I had it on top of my notebook, and I had three vice presidents take me aside and borrow it and Xerox it and give it back to me. The trouble with Don was he had to fill this news hole every week. And he got to the point that he became a one-source journalist. And he broke a lot of really insidery stuff, but he also started getting a lot of stuff wrong. And he got one really wrong and got nailed with a libel suit, which he lost. He also drank too much. He drank himself to death. When I was a cub reporter at the Mercury News, I was an investigator reporter at the Mercury a couple years later. He took me to lunch, this really drunken lunch at the Velvet Turtle, and he offered me his newsletter. I've never written that down, but he offered me his newsletter, and I remember sitting there. I was 23 years old, and this was the most powerful journalist in the Valley, and I sat there and I thought, I could get really rich doing this, and I could be really powerful. On the other hand, I would have to move somewhere else when I got done because I would have hits out on me. And it would destroy my reputation as a journalist forever. So I turned him down. But at his best, he was as good as this Valley's ever seen. And he came here writing a series for Electronic News, and he needed a byline. And he heard somebody, as the story goes, they were sitting in the Marriott Hotel, I think it was, and one of the guys says, boy, it's all chip companies around here. And the other guy said, yeah, it's a veritable Silicon Valley. And so he wrote Silicon Valley, USA as his dateline, and that gave the town its name.
When did you get that this was enough of an industry that it could be a day-to-day beat for you? And did it take any persuading to get that beat?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird story, too. I was working at HP. I got an internship out of Santa Clara to work at HP while I was working at my MBA. And I started reading Don Heffler's newsletter, and I started reading some other really good reporters at the time covering the Valley. And I really wanted to be a journalist, so I went to work at the Mercury News. But I was also a columnist. I had been a columnist in college. I was almost expelled for what I was writing in college at Santa Clara. And I really wanted to be a columnist. And the feature section of the Merc wanted to hire me as a youth columnist, writing for the baby boomer generation. That's how long ago it was. And, oh, I thought this would be the greatest job in the world. Looking back, it would have been hell on wheels. And I would have hit a dead end, you know, the moment that I could grow a beard. I mean, what would I have done after that? You know, I've been a sad guy writing about aging baby boomers for the rest of my life. But the business section wanted me too. And normally you're not allowed to go from corporate PR to journalism, but they were so desperate. They had nobody covering Silicon Valley. In fact, no paper in the world had anybody covering it, that Jim Mitchell, who had just been hired as a business editor, begged for me and got me. And I was the most disappointed guy in the world when I showed up at the newsroom with the Mercury, and I had to go over to those dreary business guys when I could have been over with the fun guys that went to rock concerts over in the living section. So during my time at the Merc, I sneak over there, and you know, Lee Weimers and I got to be really, really good friends because I would hide from the business section by sitting over by him in the living department. Yeah.
ARM has monopolized the mobile market. What do you see as Intel's future contribution?
Ah, ARM, interesting company. Seemed to come out of nowhere, developed an open system for developing processors for mobile. They got mobile when Intel didn't. And they and Qualcomm and Samsung made tremendous inroads. Biggest threat maybe Intel's had since the Japanese threat. ARM's an interesting company. It has some interesting internal problems that anybody here who's been a large corporation will appreciate. If you make an expenditure over $1,000 at ARM, you have to get a vice presidential signature. Now imagine how fast a company can move when you've got to do that. I think they've had a great run. I think that the sheer mass of the chip companies like Intel now turning, you know, it's sort of like the 16-inch guns are coming around. We'll see how long ARM can withstand that onslaught. Qualcomm, very interesting company. They seem to understand mobile better than anybody alive, including mobile health. But they're in a lot of businesses, just like Samsung. And companies that are not purely in the semiconductor industry almost always lose the race. They can't make the kind of commitment of intellectual capital and money it takes to stay in this game. Yes. Probably not at the VP level. I had a guy who was working there. Okay, I'll stand by your correction, but I'll also stand by my sources that I think maybe at your level not, but we'll talk later.
But that's what, yeah. Only in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, only in Silicon Valley. I love that. Yeah.
You know, I am remiss in not having asked you when you first mentioned the law, when you were talking about
Moore's Law.
I didn't ask you to clarify for our audience what that is. Our audience is all over the country. So, and
yes.
I also want you to address...
This audience knows what Moore's Law
is. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
But I'd like
for
you to clarify
country.
What that is. Yes,
okay.
For the country.
I think, actually, the world is beginning to finally understand Moore's Law. I mean, we kept, for years, in the Valley, we kept yelling about Moore's Law, and nobody seemed to notice. The simple fact was, if you go back to 1969, now, Moore came up with the Moore's Law 65. 1969, the annus mirabilis of the modern world, Woodstock, man on the moon, the invention of the beginning of the internet, and the microprocessor all occur at the same time, roughly the same summer almost. Intel's microprocessor slid down towards Christmas, but literally the second half of 1969 changes the world forever. Most people at the time were looking at Woodstock and saying, oh, it's a cultural shift forever. It's going to be a new world. A lot of people were we were all looking at Neil Armstrong walking on the moon and saying, our future space, we're all going to be living on Mars in 20 years. Those things didn't come true. If you look at demographics of the baby boom, if you looked at almost any trend line in 1969 and tried to predict the future, you would have gotten it wrong. The The one thing nobody was looking at were those guys in the crew cuts and the white shirts in the lab at Intel inventing the microprocessor. If you had followed Moore's law, extrapolated it out, you would have had a much better glimpse. You would have been much more capable of predicting the future accurately than any other measure.
And Moore's law is?
And the law is. Okay. Basically, Gordon Moore sat down with an assignment from Electronics Magazine. He was still at Fairchild. The assignment from Electronics Magazine to write something about the pace of change in the electronics industry. And so he sat down with some graph paper, and he only had a few data points, because memory had only been around for a handful of years. And we're talking chips with 16,000 bits of memory. You know, we're 10 billion now. And he plotted them on some graph paper and realized that the line he was drawing was a parabola, half a parabola, hyperbolic line. It went straight off the top of the graph paper, fast. And so he wadded up that sheet and threw it away and got out some log paper and graphed it again, and he got a nice, shallow, straight line. And he realized, oh, 30%, you know, angle of the line, that chip performance was doubling at that point every 18 months. You know, later it was 24 months. Now there's some debate if it's 30 months. But literally chip performance was doubling every couple, 3 years. And if you drew that out, you came out with these impossible numbers of how many transistors you could stuff on a single chip or how cheap it would be for, you know, literally Moore's law goes along several axes: size, performance, price. Okay, and what you, if you hold any two of those stable, the other one goes through the roof. So the chips then, if you had just hung on to those, they would cost a thousandth of a cent, maybe a millionth of a cent now. Mostly we follow performance, and they've gone up a billion times, okay, in those that short amount of time. Nothing in human history has advanced at that rate, and that's why the world looks the way it looks today, because Moore's law hasn't stopped. And Moore's law isn't really a law. That's the crucial thing that I hope the audience understands. There are laws. You know, Metcalfe's law of networks is a law. It says you add another node in the network, you get, you know, X squared value of the network. Okay, Moore's law is an agreement. It's a social contract made between the semiconductor industry and the world that says we're going to continue this pace as long as we can, until we literally hit a wall of physics we can't get past. Well, the assumption was Moore's law was just an anomaly and it would last 10 years. It's lasted 50, which is why we live in the world today that we do.
Well, give me some context on this. In 2003, the New York Times quoted you as saying, forget Moore's law because it's unhealthy.
Yeah, I said slavish devotion to Moore's law. Everyone says, oh, I declared the end of Moore's law. No, I said it's getting really expensive to do. And in fact, the world of semiconductors then didn't last much longer. The age of giant monolithic chips and all that, you know, it's changed. You know, it's constellations of chips. It's all sorts of ways around it. Moore's law continues, but not the way it was, which is another mark of the genius of the semiconductor industry. I mean, this is one of the great human intellectual achievements. We don't appreciate it, but there's literally only a couple things in human history that stand up to this kind of advance in this short a time. We are living in a historic moment. And for fun, I wrote a piece, can't remember who I wrote it for. but I basically said, Moore did us a disservice by using that log paper, because he got that nice straight line. It's nice and shallow. And we look at it and we go, oh, we can handle that. That's not that hard. And so working with the Tom Walder peer at Intel, we went back and got the original one and did it on regular graph paper. And it looks like this. And this
straight
is 2005,
up.
Right where you make that turn. Straight up. And it suddenly hits you just how big a change this is, what an achievement this is, that calculators, mini computers, personal computers, the internet, laptops, smartphones, servers, all of those things were all created in the foothills of that curve, you know. And now we're heading into the Himalayas. And each jump is more, it's literally everything we've been through We're doing that jump now a month, and it's going to be eventually a week. And the magnitude of that is staggering. It means that sitting up ahead of us on the curve are things, not only things we can imagine. I mean, we just saw what happened with big data and analytics in the last couple years. And the fact that the Facebooks of the world can reach 1 billion people, and that there's 4 billion smartphones or cell phones out there in the world. This has all happened just in this decade. Ahead of us is sitting the quantified self, where we monitor everything in our body. The sensor revolution is underway. We're not that far from, we're literally leaving the world of sampling and statistics and moving into a world in which we measure everything.
Real numbers.
Real numbers, like every fish in the sea. We already track every tree in the Amazon. People don't realize that, but we're already doing that. Ahead, 3D printing, nanotechnology, and after that, levels of modeling that are indistinguishable from reality. And beyond that, I don't know, the singularity, I mean, where we put our brains onto computers. All these things are within the realm of imagination now because Moore's Law keeps going. And every time you read this little bit of news that seems minor, like IBM discovered a new, you know, one molecule silicon gate, and you think, oh, cool, whatever. What that the real message of that is, they just moved Moore's Law another 5 years out. You know, wherever it ends now, 2030. I'm a great believer in human ingenuity, especially with semiconductors and the commitment of companies like Intel. They're going to keep pushing it for a long, long time. We're going to be under the regime of Moore's Law for the rest of our lives, and maybe our children's lives.
Question from the audience actually dovetails with a question I wanted to ask you. Question from the audience, what are Gordon Moore and Andy Grove doing now? And I wanted you to integrate into that. Apparently, your last meeting before the book was published with Andy Grove was notable.
Still in touch with him. They're both getting quite aged. Everybody knows Andy's health problems between the Parkinson's and the prostate cancer. Gordon's, you know, fragile, but both these guys still have minds like steel traps. I mean, Andy and I have always had difficulties. We've never really had a happy, pleasant conversation. And when I visited Andy, as I was writing the end of this book, the coda to this book, you know, Andy basically excoriated me for the first half an hour, telling me what a big jerk I was, and he remembered every single time I had crossed him from 1975 on. He didn't talk to me for 10 years. But the thing about Andy was, this is telling about Andy, he didn't talk to me for 10 years, but when he wrote Only the Paranoid Survive, he called me and asked me if I would review the book as harshly as I could. And I thought, nobody else in this town would do something, that combination of things. They're getting very old. They're in their valedictory phase. But I think Gordon's mostly in Hawaii now for health reasons. Andy's got an office in Los Altos. There's still a presence. There's still the spirits guiding over Intel. I always get kind of a clutch in my throat when I walk in. I see the picture of Bob Noyce on the wall of Intel's headquarters building, the Bob Noyce building, because he was such a remarkable, charismatic guy. I mean, he really, if you didn't know him, people here know him will agree with me, what an amazing character. I mean, really a unique. And the Valley really lost something. When he died early, relatively early, something went out of this Valley that's never really come back. For all of our success subsequent and all that, we haven't had Bob Noyce. And he was important, very important.
You've said that the people who've followed his era are too dysfunctional to take on his kind of mantle.
Yeah, I was asked to give 2 minutes on anything I want to talk about in Silicon Valley, and I got up and I said, Silicon Valley needs a mayor. We used to have a mayor. We got a lot of small mayors who are more problem than they're worth, but the Valley used to have the, you know, informal mayor, the honorary mayor. The first one was Fred Terman, who built, you know, Sanford Industrial Park, taught the first generation, you know, Bill and Dave and the rest, the Varian brothers. Second one was Dave Packard, and there's some folks here who work for Dave Packard. And You know, talking about Dave Packer is kind of like talking about George Washington. He sort of looked like George Washington. But he's almost receded into the history, you know, the mists of the Valley history. Bob Noyce then was the next one. Bob Noyce led this town through one of the most difficult phases, when the Valley was really under assault by Japanese semiconductor companies and the Valley was hurting badly. And Noyce went to Washington and led the U.S. in a counterattack and won. With his death, everyone assumed Bob would live to be about 80, you know, like Packard. And so we'd have this, you know, this mayor until about the turn of the century, and we didn't get it. And with Noyce's departure, who was going to take his place? The next generation was Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison. No. You're not going to put those guys in charge of a community. And you follow those guys with the dot-com bubble, you know, the guys in the black turtlenecks on their Aeron chairs in San Francisco with their MFAs, you know, are they going to speak for the semiconductor industry? No. And so here we are. Noyce has been gone now for 25 years. There's been no one to replace him. And this Valley needs some sort of leadership. And until we get that, I think we tend to speak in a lot of different voices. So I suggested John Hennessy at Stanford. Doesn't he sound like, wouldn't he be perfect? But I think John wants to, you know, be a cardinal for a little longer than go on a beach somewhere. But we really do need a single voice for this town, and we haven't had it for a long time.
And we really do need to move toward a closer. I've got time for one more question. And it dovetails with all the passion I just saw while you were talking about Silicon Valley and talking about these people. While I was reading your book, I was thinking to myself, you could almost have done this as a first person. At least the last two-thirds of it could have been first person, because you knew these people so well, or, you know, had enough integration into their lives, enough personal contact. And I wonder, as someone who was approaching a topic that was, you know, so close to you, how did you manage to stay the journalist in the midst of all this?
Tough. It was just serendipity that my father retired from the Air Force and went to work for NASA in 1963. So I can, and I grew up in Mountain View. And so, you know, there's Steve Jobs on the schoolyard of Monoloma Elementary School in Mountain View with me. He was a year behind me. And then we moved to Sunnyvale about the same time, and now I see Wozniak's on the swim team with my buddies. And this little corner right near where I lived, it's one of the great historic nexuses of human history, because on a given afternoon in the 1960s, you would have seen Ted Hoff coming home, who lived at the corner, Bob Noyce racing his Mercedes down Fremont Avenue to Los Altos Country Club, because he lived right on the back of the country club, and Steve Wozniak coming up Bernardo to go on to Wright Avenue, coming home from Cherry Chase swim practice, which means that basically the inventor of the integrated circuit, the inventor of the microprocessor, and the inventor of the personal computer were all crossing each other at 5 o'clock at night at this anonymous intersection underneath a freeway overpass. I got to HP when I was still in college. So the very first day I ate in the corporate cafeteria, this giant guy sat on one side of me and this short, squat guy sat on the other side of me. I looked left and right, and here's David Packard and Bill Hewlett. Packard wrote my grad school recommendation letter. I saw Terman's last visit, his last board meeting, when he arrived at Three Upper at the very end of his life. And then I was the first technology reporter for the Merck. So I was at Apple when it was basically, they were in their building on Bub Road, and it was just Wozniak and Jobs and Markula and a few other folks. I was there. I stayed all night on a story at Google when it was about a month old. I was at eBay when Pierre and Jeff invited me in to help them design the business plan, when there were two of them. So it's just been lucky timing that I've longitudinally, I've sort of seen all of Silicon Valley. I can remember when Fairchild was at, because I lived in Mountain View, Fairchild was initially at San Antonio and California Street, what's now was a computer store. So, you know, it was just right there in my yard, basically. So I'm just lucky.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
And I hope you've all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Tech Museum and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. And thanking again Michael Malone, author of The Intel Trinity, How Robert Noyce, Gordon Moore, and Andy Grove Built the World's Most Important Company. Our audience here in San Jose and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, guys.